on my way, Mr. Chair.
Is Ms. Halleck here?
A representative from DEQ?
Yeah, Stephanie.
Oh, there she is.
Where?
Director Halleck, would you come forward, please?
No, that's Lori Onan.
Is Ms. Halleck in the audience?
No, Lori Onan, who represents the Department of Environmental Quality, is here, as is John Ledger, who asked that they come up together, Mr. Chair.
Okay.
And we're in a work session on 3175, correct?
We're in a work session on 3175. Committee, we have amendments to this bill. As you recall, we have had prior testimony, and these were amendments to a work group. The work group came up with the amendments. So, good morning, John. Good morning, Lori.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm John Ledger with Associated Oregon Industries. The amendments you have before you are requested by Representative Knope, who is the sponsor of the bill. And the bill had a hearing, and a work group was appointed, and the work group met at least once. They were fairly long, convoluted meetings. And in the end, I think the result is a greatly reduced bill, and you have it in front of you. You have the amendments, and you also have an actual markup of the bill stapled to the amendments. And this is not a...
Yes, Mr. Chair, I just want to clarify that we're on the dash 2 amendments, not the dash 1 amendments.
And you can see by thumbing through the bill, this is it removes the great majority of the text. And what it retains, really the only piece it retains, is the piece of the bill that reauthorizes the DEQ Green Permits Program, makes some modifications in that language. The Green Permits Program is a model that's used throughout the nation. Oregon was one of the model startups for this. And it does sunset unless it is re-upped, and I think everybody agrees that program should be re-upped. The changes that were made in the text regarding the Green Permits Program are mostly clarifications that were things like that were the original intent, that all costs of the program be borne by the applicant, and also that the DEQ be able to receive a fairly large deposit to draw against when they review the permit. The result of this amendment is that there is no fiscal impact from the bill because the piece that would have funded DEQ positions is gone. The Green Permits Program is entirely discretionary. It's supported by AOI, and it's also supported by a fairly broad work group that met the Green Permits Advisory Group, includes environmental groups and industries. And I'd be happy to take any questions, Mr. Chairman.
Lori, why don't we have your testimony, then we'll take the questions after
and
that.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Lori Onan with the Department of Environmental Quality. I know you have a full schedule, so I really won't have much to say. I did want to say I appreciate the amendments and the clarifications they bring to the Green Permits Program. So we do support the dash 2 amendments, and to just be here to answer any questions.
Any questions in regard to the dash 2 amendments? Seeing none, thank you both very much. Okay. Representative Richardson.
Mr. Chair, I move that the dash 2 amendments to House Bill 3175 be accepted as part of House Bill 3175.
Representative Richardson has moved that the dash 2 amendments be made part of House Bill 3175. Is there a discussion? Is there any objection? If not, the clerk will call the roll.
A roll on this motion?
On the dash 2 amendments.
Rosenbaum.
Excused.
Representative Greenwood?
Aye.
Representative Doyle?
Aye.
Representative Ackerman?
Aye.
Representative Zahner?
Aye.
Representative Richardson?
Aye.
Chair Garrard?
Chair votes aye. Dash 2 amendments are accepted to House Bill 3175. Representative Richardson.
Mr. Chair, I move that House Bill 3175, as amended, be moved out of committee to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Richardson has moved that House Bill 3175, as amended, be moved to the floor with a due pass recommendation. The administrator has reminded me that this did have a subsequent renewal or a referral to Ways and Means, but since the amendment removed the cost to DEQ, now do we need a separate motion on that before we vote on the bill?
Yes, Mr. Chair, you can make a motion. You've got a motion on the table now. From a technical standpoint, you need somebody else to make another motion as to rescinding the subsequent referral to Ways and Means and vote on that, and then you would vote that the motion on the motion that's currently on the table.
Representative Richardson?
Mr. Chair, I move that the previous
subsequent
referral. Mr. Chair,
motion for a subsequent referral.
Has to be somebody else.
And these, Mr. Chair, it does need to be somebody else. Somebody needs to move.
I'll do what you say.
Mr. Chair, I move
to rescind the subsequent referral to Ways and Means.
Representative Greenland.
I move to rescind the subsequent referral to Ways and Means on 3175.
Representative Greenlick has moved to remove the subsequent referral to Ways and Means. Any discussion? Any objection? Clerk, call the roll.
Representative Rosenbaum?
Excuse?
Representative Greenlick?
Aye.
Representative Doyle?
Aye.
Representative Ackerman?
Aye.
Representative Zahner?
Aye.
Representative Richardson?
Aye.
Aye. The subsequent referral to Ways and Means is rescinded, and now we have a motion from Representative Richardson to move House Bill 3175 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Seeing none, the clerk will call the roll.
Representative Rosenbaum.
Excuse?
Representative Greenwald.
Aye.
Representative Doyle.
Aye.
Representative Ackerman.
Aye.
Representative Donner.
Aye.
Representative Richardson.
Aye.
Chair Barrard.
The chair votes aye.
Sorry.
House Bill 3175 is moved to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Since this is Representative Knope's bill, I'll check with the majority leader to see if he would like to carry it. Would Representative Rosenbaum like to vote on this bill?
I vote aye.
Can we do that?
Yes, Mr. Chair, you had not gaveled down, so that is fine.
Okay. House Bill 3175 is moved to the floor with the due pass recommendation, and Representative Knope will carry. And we will close the public hearing on House Bill 3175. Close the work session on House Bill 3175. And open a work session on House Bill 3016.
Yes, Mr. Chair, House Bill 3016 was before this committee on the 27th of March. It authorizes dwellings clustered in rural areas to be served by sewer systems. Mr. Chair, we have not received any amendments to House Bill 3016.
We do have it.
Yes, one in front of me. I stand corrected, Mr. Chair.
Okay.
And Mr. Chair, I'm informed we have some amendments.
Mm-hmm. I believe Mr. Day had the amendments.
You distributed them from the city.
On 3016?
Yeah, 3016-1.
Okay. They're here on the master.
They're in this pile.
Got him. Okay. Kelly has found the amendment.
Mr. Chair, we do have dash one amendments to House Bill.
Just you, the chair didn't get them. I think there's something here. There's a plan here, I think.
To House Bill 3016, having not had a chance to review these, I can't brief the committee on them, but I'm sure there is somebody in the audience that will be able to do that, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Kelly. Mr. Day, would you come forward, please, to discuss the amendments to House Bill 3016.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For your record, Ross Day, Director of Legal Affairs, Oregonians in Action. You may recall from previous testimony that the purpose of this bill was to allow homes in unincorporated areas, essentially outside your urban growth boundary, where it's in the original language of the bill, economically feasible. And the currently proposed dash one amendment language calls it practicable, where it's practicable for them to establish a common septic, taking into account public health and environmental concerns. This would allow them to do this. If you recall from my prior testimony, Goal 11 right now prohibits the establishment of community septic except for in certain very limited circumstances. The committee raised some very valid concerns, as did the folks from DLCD, and I think I have not talked to DLCD about these amendments, but I think they address many of the concerns. The first was what the definition of municipality and unincorporated community are. They are legally defined terms in statute and in regulation. They cover everything except for, I believe, a special fire district. So pretty much every type of sewer district, water district, local city, county, whatever. And so the term was changed to local government, which does in fact include special fire districts, but otherwise the change is relatively minimal. And second concern was the definition of clustered, specifically clustered in the original bill was defined as a group of dwelling or is economically feasible to cover, to create a common septic. The definition of clustered has been changed to require it to be practicable, which is a legal term which basically means feasible, and feasibility takes into account a number of factors, not just economic feasibility, but land use feasibility, transportation feasibility. I mean, it takes into account physical feasibility, whether or not it's physically possible, and then the remainder of the definition of clustered takes it. It really gets at the heart of what we're trying to do here. Is if this is environmentally a smart thing to do, common sense. That is, rather than having several individual septics out there, potentially presenting a significant harm to groundwater, this says, well, if this is that's the case, then you should allow common septic. The last issue that was brought up, and it was a valid one, I think, was well, what happens if down the road these common septics fail? So the amendments require dwelling owners who create these common septic or sewer systems or connections to enter into maintenance agreements for the benefit of the local government. And also requires those maintenance agreements to be recorded so that the obligation runs with the land. That way local governments are protected. They have an enforcement mechanism if they need to either recover costs or enforce maintenance of common sewer system. With that, that's the amendments in a nutshell.
It would appear, Mr. Day, that you have addressed the concerns in the original public testimony on this bill. Committee, have any questions? Representative Ackerman.
Yes, just a question I have. There's no financing mechanism here for the establishment of the trunk lines, the laterals, the construction of the sewer system. Could you give us some idea how that's to work and how it would be assessed and whom they would owe the obligation?
As an initial, Chair Gerard, Representative Ackerman, I did my homework. I pulled the case you told me to, and I read it. I would presume that the maintenance agreements entered into by the dwelling owners would provide for a share of the costs. If the property owners chose to form a local improvement district, the local improvement district procedures provide for an assessment mechanism to proportionately assess costs of the improvement. So that's how I would envision it taking place.
One follow-up question.
Follow-up.
So then there's no obligation of the local government to provide this service free?
Chair Gerard, Representative Ackerman, absolutely not.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Richardson.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Day, am I correct that when this says that this is going to constitute a deed restriction, that it means that even if a person who's part of this were to sell his property, the responsibility for maintenance will go with the land and a purchaser would buy subject to that and there would be funding even if there's a change in ownership?
Chair Gerard, Vice Chair Richardson, that's correct.
Okay. Representative Greenlee.
Finished. Cleaning up the mess, I mean. Can you talk a little bit about Section 4, what used to be Section 3? Do you have some inventory of how many regulations they would have to go through to figure out how to rescind what? I mean, you obviously have no way of knowing the future and what might come down, but is this thousands of regulations, hundreds? Would the regulations have other effects besides the effects of allowing a community sewer system? Do you have any sense, I mean, is there something hidden here that we need to know?
Chair Gerard, Representative Greenlee, not that I'm aware of and not that I'm intending either. My understanding is that Goal 11 is, wouldn't require a repeal of Goal 11. It would perhaps require a modification of Rule 11, or an amendment, I should say, but it, as far as I know, there may be some rules out there that need to be repealed or in the alternative are unenforceable.
And you use the word, may I follow up, sir? Amend or repeal, I mean, does that restrict the amendment to this topic? Or?
Chair Gerard, Representative Greenlee, let's get away from the amendment and repeal for the moment, and I would just suggest to you that in the event a rule, a regulation, or a goal, or whatever conflicts with state statute, with the direct policy contained in state statute, that rule or regulation is not enforceable. So, to the extent a regulation collaterally conflicts with this statute, I don't know that rule would need to be amended or repealed. Only as they pertain directly to establishment of common sewer outside urban growth boundaries. That's it.
Representative, we had Bob Rindy was here a moment ago, and I don't know if he's out in the hallway. Harlan, would you see if he's out there? Might have LCDC come in and address the Section 4 question that was brought up by Representative Greenlee. Bob, could you have you had a chance to look at these amendments on 3016?
No.
Well, you're really under the gun then.
Section 4.
Actually, it's the same section that was in the bill prior to the amendment.
We would have to repeal or amend Goal 11 and administrative rule.
Representative Greenlee, would you repeat the question so that Mr. Rindy could...
My question is, I mean, I was looking for some inventory of what would need to be repealed. And you're suggesting all of Goal 11 would need to be repealed?
Well, it wouldn't be a Mr. Chair, Representative Greenlee, Bob Rindy for the record. This bill would cause us to amend Goal 11. We would not repeal it. Simply, we, at the end of each legislative session, have to make sure that our goals and administrative rules are consistent with statute. We wouldn't want to have a statute out there that gave a different message than this would have, so we would amend Goal 11.
And if I may, what does Goal 11 specifically say with regard to this?
Chair, Representative Greenlee, the Goal 11 generally deals with public facilities. Most of it applies to areas within urban growth boundaries, but it does have a paragraph that with regard to surfaces outside of urban growth boundaries, and that paragraph has some limits on where sewers may be extended, and those limits, I think, are what would be contradicted by this. So that paragraph would be changed.
If I might, Chair Garrard, Representative Greenlee, Goal 11 also prohibits the establishment of community sewer. When I say community, I mean shared community sewer as well.
That's correct in some areas. In rural communities, those are permitted, and in health hazard areas, those are permitted. But it does prohibit establishment of those in some other rural areas.
Are there any other questions, Representative Roosevelt?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Russ, I'd just like to clarify again, I think that Representative Ackerman was getting at this question, but on page 2, this language that says that property owners have to agree to proportionate shares of the cost of maintenance of the system, does that mean that the entire cost of repairing one of these systems, if it fails, and the testimony was they have a higher failure rate for smaller systems, would be borne by the property owners and none of it would be borne by the local government? That's not clear to me from this language.
Chair Garrard, Representative Rosenbaum, appreciate your question. That is the intention, that the local governments are held harmless from the costs. And that's the way it works now. If I have a septic system out on my rural, 20 acres, and my septic fails, I get to bear the costs of fixing it.
But just follow up, Mr. Chair, to clarify, we're now talking about a community-owned system that's put in and normally would be maintained by the local government. This is a different arrangement from what would apply to the rest of the property owners in that jurisdiction, I assume.
Chair Garrard, Representative Rosenbaum, I use the term community loosely, not to mean necessarily an unincorporated community or a local government or a municipality, but rather a group of dwellings that decide, hey, we're going to get together and this makes a lot of sense, both practically and also environmentally. It's silly to have several septic systems out there. Why not just share one? It's similar to, it would be akin to a single person who decides that they're going to set up their own septic system. It would be no different than that, except for instead of one person, you've got presumably several property owners who have decided this is something that we should do. And it's not the intent of this bill that the local governments or whoever be held responsible for the cost of maintenance.
Any further questions?
Thank you, gentlemen.
We are in work session. Representative Richardson?
Mr. Chair, I move that.
We do have a referral of Ways and Means. Committee, we've just been informed by the administrator this bill will have to have a referral to Ways and Means.
So, do you have before or after we have an amendment that's part of the bill?
Mr. Chair, Representative Richardson, the committee needs to adopt the amendment move the amendment into the bill, which replaces the original measure. Subsequent to that, the committee, as I've been informed by the Legislative Fiscal Office, will need to add a subsequent referral to this measure to the Ways and Means Committee, and the committee can take a motion for either without recommendation as passage or some recommendation as to passage
to the Ways and Means Committee as amended.
Mr. Chair, I move that House Bill 316 be amended with House Bill 316-1 amendments.
Representative Richardson has moved that we accept the dash one amendments to House Bill 3016. Any discussion? Seeing none, clerk will call the roll.
Representative Rosenbaum.
Aye.
Representative Greenwood.
Aye.
Representative Doyle.
Aye.
Representative Ackerman.
Aye.
Representative Zahner.
Aye.
Representative Richardson.
Aye.
Chair Girard.
Chair votes aye. The dash one amendments to House Bill 3016 are adopted, and now we need a motion for referral to Ways and Means.
Okay. Mr. Chair, I move that House Bill 316, as amended, be referred to Ways and Means with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Richardson has moved House Bill 3016, as amended, to Ways and Means with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Greenland.
I still have rookie learning things to learn, and I'm not really quite sure about the conflict of interest statements, but I do want to put into the record that my view on this, while I see the general both positive and negative on this, both as a public healther and as somebody interested in land use, I also own a beach house in a cluster of homes that is clearly going to have, has had problems with septic and could easily use this alternative if it was available to it. So, I don't think it's exactly a conflict of interest in the formal rules. It does.
You have to vote your own. You have to vote your own wastewater.
Yeah. No, it is. That's my point. And I vote might come from a law that could help is I've always argued that there are lots of laws we might pass that could help us.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, from the formal standpoint, in order for there to be a conflict, a potential conflict of interest, the representative would have to have what's called a pecuniary interest in the bill. That's some either possible financial gain or loss for that individual representative or a list of those relatives in statute.
I thank the administrator for flushing out that information. Okay. Seeing no further discussion, the clerk will call the roll.
Representative Rosenbaum.
Aye.
Representative Greenland.
Aye.
Representative Doyle.
Aye.
Representative Ackerman.
Aye.
Representative Zahner.
Aye.
Representative Richardson.
Aye.
Chair Girard.
Chair votes aye. House Bill 3016, as amended, is moved to Ways and Means with a due pass recommendation. We'll close the work session on House Bill 3016 and open a public hearing on House Bill 3228. Mr. Administrator.
Mr. Chair, House Bill 3228 defines development for the purposes of land use planning goals adopted to protect beaches and dunes. It authorizes the Land Conservation and Development Commission to limit use of beachfront protective structures to protect coastal development. Goal 18, Mr. Chair, members of the Committee of Oregon Statewide Planning Goals and Guidelines, sets the Land Conservation and Development Commission's implementation policy regarding beaches and dunes. In accordance with current guidelines for implementation of Goal 18, dune stabilization program should only be allowed when in conformance with the comprehensive plan and only after assessment of their potential impact. Further, guidelines state the plans for four dune grading should be based on clear consideration of the fragility and ever-changing nature of the four dune and its importance for protection from flooding and erosion. For the committee's information, Mr. Chair, these are contained in Oregon Administrative Rules, Chapter 660, implements statewide goals and guidelines, and specifically Oregon Administrative Rules, Chapter 660, Division 15, Chapter 10, Sub 3, covers beaches and dunes. Mr. Chair, you do have a dash one amendment before you, and the dash one amendment's effect is that it does not allow the Land Conservation and Development Commission to limit beachfront protective structures to protect coastal development that occurred prior to January 1, 1977. Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Administrator. committee work, we're not going to be able to have a work session on this bill because it does need to be amended. But do we have a sign-up sheet?
Yes, we're getting that, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair, I don't seem to find a staff measure summary on this bill.
There is one there.
Is it
should there? Have one there, Representative. If not, we'll see that you get one immediately.
It's buried. This is some of the stuff there.
I have an extra one. This one. Here you go.
Thank you.
Yeah. We have, let's see, 8 people signed up to testify on this bill, and it's pretty evenly divided, 4-4, and a couple against and a couple neutral. And again, we have a full schedule, so I'll appreciate those that will be testifying this morning to keep the comments to a maximum of 5 minutes each. And we'll call up Art Schleck from AOC, Matt Spangler, and Nan Evans. Good morning, Mr. Schleck.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Art Schleck. I'm with the Association of Oregon Counties. You will be receiving shortly a copy of written statement that I've prepared regarding this bill. Let me just say very quickly that the Association of Oregon Counties and the League of Oregon Cities both urge your support of this bill. It's a very simple bill, and I'm pleased at this point to indicate to you that based on some conversations this morning, we understand with another small amendment that the Department of Land Conservation and Development will remove its objection to the bill. This bill is about one small thing, and that is what is included in the term development as it relates to Goal 18 and development that existed prior to January 1, 1977. The proposed amendment will include infrastructure, roads, sewer, and water lines as part of the term development expressly. We believe that it's there as you look at the goal currently, in as much as the goal provides for the fact that you do not need an exception for a beachfront protective device for residential, commercial, industrial development, and even the protection of vacant lots and subdivisions. And how you can protect them without protecting a road or a sewer or water line is beyond us. DLCD at this point supports that. Mr. Chair, with that, I'm going to conclude my comments and reserve those for another day if it's necessary. Nan Evans is here. Matt Spangler from Lincoln County, who has hands-on experience at this point. Just conclude my comments and let Nan make her comment, and then we can get the amendment and get this bill moved down the road, hopefully.
Thank you, Mr. Schleck. Good morning, Nan.
Morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Nan Evans, the interim director of the Department of Land Conservation and Development. The department and the commission engaged in a rulemaking this last interim to amend Goal 18 because the issue was brought to us from ODOT. And we worked with ODOT to define the issue about how big it was, and we're prepared to go to our commission with a request to amend the rule and the goal. At that time, the issue of local infrastructure came before the commission. The commission, on the request of the Transportation Commission, then paused its rulemaking. And that sort of brought us to where we are today with the question of what is the definition of development and what does it expand to? The position of the department today is that we could support the bill with a couple of comments. We could support the Section 2, subparagraph 2 that defines development if the date January 1, 1977 were added so that it were clear that that date applied to all those the items listed there, and if Section 2, subparagraph 1 were removed from the bill. The issue there is subparagraph 1 refers to the ability of the commission and the ability of the goal language to talk about the criteria under which particular structures, riprap structures, are evaluated, and we believe that's a very important component to remain in the goal language and to have the evaluation of particular structures to those criteria still part of the process. Now, there are a couple of other minor issues. That's probably not a good characterization. There are a couple of other issues that we could talk about. There are some issues that have been raised this morning by our general counsel that probably could be worked through. So I guess I will really shorten my testimony here. You've got a written copy of it, and just say that if those changes were made, the department would not oppose the bill.
Thank you, Ms. Evans. Good morning.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Matt Spangler. I'm the Planning and Development Director for Lincoln County over in Newport. Appreciate the opportunity to be here this morning. Just first let me say that we're in support of the bill and support the position of AOC and LLC in this matter. What I'd like to do this morning is just very briefly cover a couple of points that I think are important to help you understand the need for this particular bill. First is the policy regarding beachfront protective structures that's contained in Goal 18. And that policy is really a very simple policy, and that is that these kinds of structures, these hard shoreline structures, riprap seawalls, are prohibited for new development. And new development is development that occurred after January 1 of 1977, which was the effective date of the policy contained in Goal 18. So again, the policy itself is a very simple policy and has a simple application. The policy is a prohibition, and the application is that it applies prospectively from 77 forward. Conversely, it does not apply retroactively to development that existed prior to the effective date of the goal. The second issue I think would be helpful for you to understand is a little bit about the history of Goal 18 and the reason that this bill, I think, is before you now. When Goal 18 was originally adopted in 1977, it simply used the term development in that 77 policy provision. It did not further define, qualify, or limit the term development in any way. And I can tell you that in practice, the term development was given its common meaning, not just buildings and homes, but also streets, highways, bridges, other forms of infrastructure. All of the customary elements of the built environment were considered to be development. In 1984, the goal was amended to insert the present definition, and that definition was added to Goal 18 as part of this general review of the coastal goals that was directed by the legislature, along with a number of other amendments. As a person who was closely involved in the process of developing those amendments that were eventually recommended to the LCDC, I can tell you that there was no intent in formulating that definition to somehow exclude customary forms of development. The idea with that definition was to address a fairly narrow issue, and that was how does Goal 18 treat vacant lots in otherwise developed areas? Unfortunately, in the process of getting at that particular issue, the definition was narrowed considerably, and so we went from a very broad, inclusive definition to a fairly narrow definition that simply omitted the obvious, which includes streets, roads, highways, other forms of infrastructure. So in my view, the current definition in Goal 18 is simply the result of an oversight in that process in 1984. But the intent of the drafters notwithstanding, we're now fixed with this particular definition that at best is ambiguous, at worst, applied literally, excludes a number of forms of pre-77 development from the protected provision of Goal 18. In my view, that's clearly contrary to the original intent of the rules, and I think that this particular bill is, again, as Art characterized it, simple, and it does the job of fixing that particular problem. So, again, just to kind of reemphasize, I guess my main point here is that this bill would not change the fundamental original underlying policy of Goal 18. It rather reaffirms that policy, and I hope that provides you with a little bit of clarity on that history. And again, I appreciate the opportunity to be here this morning.
Mr. Chair, if I might just make two other little points at this point for you. First, Goal 18 talks about beachfront protective devices, and you may hear about riprap and seawalls, as Mr. Spangler just mentioned, but it also deals with big jute bags that they put sand in that they put on the beach to help stabilize the beach, and the beach returns to its normal appearance at this point. So anything that is basically put on the beach to help stabilize it, and it could be very soft treatments as well as the hardest treatment would be riprap. The other thing that I would point to you is, and it's in my letter, the fact that if this bill passes, the state parks has another permit process that you have to go through that basically looks at the same issues and looks at any kind of protective device has to be in the least or a minimal impact to the beach and those things. And so there is a backstop. There is a in the state parks permit process, there is a check and a balance to ensure that Oregon's beaches maintain the quality that we all support and appreciate. And I just want to make sure that the committee understands that the state parks have a responsibility. They've been doing their work for a long time, and that will continue uninterrupted by this bill. Thank you.
Any questions of this panel? Representative Richardson.
Mr. Chair, Ms. Evans, I'm not sure if the date 1977 was added to Section 2 so that it was very clear that we're talking about that which took place prior to 1977, what would be your objection to having it remain in Chapter 197?
That's what amendments, doesn't it?
Well, she said she doesn't want that.
Mr. Chair.
No, she does.
Mr. Chair, Representative Richardson, let me be real clear here. I don't have a copy of the bill in front of me, but if you look at Section 2, Sub 1, I believe the language talks about preventing LCDC from doing rules, something, something. That's the section that we object to. Section 2, Sub 2, thank you, that says for the purposes the definition of development is thus and so. If the phrase were added, the in Section 2, Sub 2, if the phrase were added in there that development applied only to those structures that existed prior to January 1, 1977, then we could support it. Now, let me say a couple of other things here. So am I clear there?
No, I understood that. Yeah. I thought that you'd also said that you wouldn't want that to, you wanted the entire Section 1 to be deleted from the original bill.
No, Section 2, Sub 1.
Okay.
Is what I would want to read. If I may, to just be perhaps a couple other points of clarity, there are some questions about what the definition of residential structure might be. Currently, the language says residences or homes. We would want to work with council so that residential structures didn't include, you know, a garden box or something. So it would protecting something of real value. And that would be one minor piece to look at. Another issue that was raised by council this morning with respect to an issue Mr. Slack raised is there is a question about the application to state-owned lands, and primarily that would be state parks. And that's an issue that would need to be worked out in council. And I don't think we need to take much time here. But the summary of my testimony is Section 2, Sub 2, if the date were added, and Section 2, Sub 1 were deleted.
Mr. Chair, can I follow up? Have you seen the Dash 1 amendments? Hey. It's my impression the Dash 1 amendments do what you've just asked, and I wondered whether it's your impression as well.
I think I looked at it quickly, and I think they did not.
They put in the 1977 date in sub 1.
The issue here is as I read it, is that in adopting any goals, LCDC may not limit the use of beachfront protecting structures that occurred on or before January 1. The question there is, the goal contains some criteria about what structures must meet in order to be permitted. For instance, structures must be evaluated on whether or not they incur a cost to the public, either financially with respect to repair issues or in cost to the public in terms of use of the beach. That's the problem we have with Section 2, Sub 1, is it would prevent the application of those criteria that are in the goal language to structures that would be built or could be built to protect development prior to January 1, 1977.
If I may follow. So the criteria, well, you can't stop it from happening to development that happened before 77. The criteria can direct the nature of it.
That's correct.
And you want to make sure this doesn't.
That's
so
correct.
We would see some amendments that would clarify both the 77 date, the streets, and would not take away your ability to guide.
That's correct. And those criteria, Mr. Chair and Representative Greenlake, are in fact the criteria that state parks used to write their rules to administer the beach permits. And that's how that's linked together.
And we're going to see amendments like that from the, is that right? I mean, I guess I don't know who we're asking here.
But we have a lot of, much more thank testimony you. Yet. So, okay. Any further questions? Seeing none, thank you, panel. Luna Hosing? Mr. Hosing's traveled over 100 miles today to come give his testimony.
So the port is right on the borderline.
Well, Representative Brown told us it was, you know, at the end of the universe. So,
thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Ono Husing. I'm the director of the Oregon Coastal Zone Management Association. It's an association that's been around since 1976, comprised of counties, cities, ports, and soil and water conservation districts up and down the Oregon coast. So, in effect, we do a lot of the kind of things that AOC and LOC does, but we focus on that special collection of coastal issues that doesn't affect other cities and counties. And, of course, we have ports in our jurisdiction as well. I have submitted extensive written testimony to the committee that outlines what is a very tortured history behind this, and there's absolutely no reason to go into that today. In your leisure, I would invite you to look at it because I think it demonstrates kind of how state government works and the difficulty that we have when you have multiple agencies looking at the same things. I do want to say that I'm honored to serve on the governor's transition team as well, and I'm not speaking today for the governor's office, of course, but I do recall that during the campaign, the governor came to the coast, and I was literally seduced by some of the things that he was saying about getting our land use system and our regulatory system under control. And so there's a big philosophical issue underpinning this bill is how many state agencies do we have looking at the same things, and how long do we run applicants through the system? You know, I have a law degree and a planning degree. I've served on the Lincoln County Planning Commission for 8 or 9 years. I went to the UR Law School to study environmental law. I have an ocean coastal law certificate. I was in the private practice for 7 or 8 years doing a lot of regulatory things. And time again, people don't mind putting up or responding to environmental regulations. They just want to know how long it's going to take. They want a process that makes sense. And that's what I think what you have before you is that we basically codify what has been the existing practice. And that's all spelled out in the extensive testimony that has a lot of history. And ultimately, I'm saying this is on a larger philosophical basis because I think that Oregon's land use planning system is a tremendous asset for our state. And it fundamentally, the concepts codified in that program back in the 73 legislature are exceedingly sound and give us a competitive edge in our nation. Again, it's a good thing. It's all, however, in the application of those policies. And over time, and I'll use a maritime analogy, there are barnacles start growing on the system. And it's not because anyone's mean-spirited or wants to create a Byzantine system that people have getting through. It just kind of sounds good to have multiple layers of review. So if an issue doesn't get addressed here, well, then it'll get addressed here or it'll get addressed here. I remember last session, I'll conclude on this, good friend of mine, former Senator Springer, who was testifying for the Sierra Club on a regulatory streamlining bill, said, it might have been in this committee hearing, he said to the legislators, well, you know, redundant systems are good. I mean, think about it. When you're in an airplane at 26,000 feet, you're glad that there's a backup to the hydraulic line. And I'm sitting there listening to that. I'm going, well, yeah, on some very superficial level, of course you're glad there's two or three redundant systems in an airplane. But the degree to which people have to face redundant systems to get through permit process where you really have fundamentally the same issues addressed by state parks, that's a bad way to do business. And I've invited some of my friends in the governor's office, and I've many legislators that I know that I've talked to, and I've said, all right, what is the first thing you should do in a regulatory streamlining exercise? Look at a flow chart of how a process exists right now. If you see too many horizontal boxes, you know you got a problem. And again, it's this very easy thing, and I know it's easy for legislators to say redundant processes are good because, oh, if this agency misses it, then we can do it over here, and if this agency misses it, we can do it over here. It's that well-meaning approach that I believe is exactly the motive that's gotten us into a system which right now is creaking and breaking. And Measure 7 was a clear statement to all of us to examine the system. And the challenge, I believe, and I've written it in the testimony, is squarely this. How do we keep the fundamental aspects of Oregon's land use system in place, but at the same time give people who have to go through it a reasonable process where they have reasonable expectations and reasonable costs? And I believe if we're successful with this new governor and with the mindset of this legislature of approaching that in a fair-minded way, that ultimately we could have the same kind of outstanding environmental outcomes, but it's going to cost us a lot less. And ultimately, that's what's going to save Oregon's great land use experiment over time. I will close and say that the ODOT estimates that these are their statistics, that a mildly controversial goal exception takes 3 years and $100,000. And believe me, the local jurisdictions that I work for can't afford, on those rare occasions when they even have to do this, that kind of money to go through that. And I've articulated there a vision for what we really need to do. You know, riprap's a bad thing. It can have impacts on beaches. And you'll hear testimony about that. I agree 100%. No one wants to put riprap down. But if you look at my testimony, The Department of Geology and Mineral Industries right now has a coastal field office. Ironically, it was Senator George, no darling of the environmental movement, who created that post on the coast in the 1999 legislature. Right now, and they happen to be housed right in our offices in Newport, so I know these guys really well. They have the ability to finally understand what is going on with Oregon's beaches. And that is going to provide us, in a couple years' time, the kind of information that State Parks needs. Because, again, they're the ones that carry out this program for the pre-77 riprap permits that come to them. They have, look at, I challenge you, look at their authority. They have unbelievable discretion to say no to any kind of ocean shore permit from pre-77. In fact, when I went through this process, when I looked at that, those regulations, it almost took my breath away because it was, God, if they don't like anything about a riprap proposal, they can say no. But what they need, what State Parks needs, is a better scientific context to judge these pre-77 applications, all these house applications that come up during El Nino years when there's more erosion. You know, and ultimately in 5 or 10 years, once they really get going and they get a better scientific context and the technologies are there to understand how our beaches work, I believe what we'll ultimately have is an ability to say, there's a stretch of beach right now that's particularly vulnerable to these problems with the beach going away. If you lock up the sand supply and harden the beach, we shouldn't even allow those permits to go forward because they will have an unacceptable impact on Oregon's beaches. So I say, my conclusion of my written testimony, that's what we really should be looking at. We should be celebrating the fact that DeGamy is developing the kind of technical expertise to take us into a whole new generation of a context to evaluate all the pre-77 applications. And I don't want you to be misled that somehow we're seeking local governments, that is. And we don't think ODOT should have to spend that kind of money to go through duplicative processes either. But we're not trying to relax the system. We're trying to restore a policy that's been in place for a number of years. Please look at my testimony. You'll see it laid out there. At that, I've probably exceeded my 5 minutes, but I've spent a lot of time and energy on this in the last year or so, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. We're very pleased the Department of Land Conservation has come forward with their amendments. I'm confident we can work through those few issues. We'll explore that other issue that's hanging out there with this possible loophole or unaddressed issue in the state parks' process, because we certainly don't want this to have any unintended consequences. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Richardson.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Husing, I want to thank you for the time and effort that you put into putting together this history and this layout. I also have no animosity toward proper planning, but there are several of the legislators who are advocates for the people and are feeling the sense of anxiety and consternation that the public feels for having to deal with so many different obstacles. We do not get a flowchart with blocks showing redundancy. And so, and we may not have ever processed a permit ourselves.
Right.
And so the information you're providing, and if you happen to have a flowchart showing blocks with redundancy, I'd like to see it, because I don't really understand what is involved with someone that is on a beach and has this kind of a problem. And so this kind of
I will generate. Basically, if you saw a flowchart, you'd see, in effect, if you went ahead and suddenly said that infrastructure is not development for pre-77, which is on its face is pretty bizarre and weird. But let's say you said that and you agreed with that. My preference is, if we wanted to reach back, we should have been up front with the LCDC and others and have this issue of having an elevated public review for public structures. Have that up front, but instead you kind of went around and did this. But you would see two blocks, you'd have that parallel structure, not three or four, but you'd have two. And some people, again, would say, we want full public involvement. So what does that mean, three or four of these systems to run through? I'd rather have, like, one good carburetor there, or one good, filter to run it through where the issues got addressed in that one box. And that's the challenge, is to make sure that the one box that's remaining in a flow chart, this is just a general statement about regulatory streamline, that one box has got to be good, though. It's got to be the right filter. It's got to address all of the public concerns and have adequate public review, opportunities to raise issue, all those kinds of things. And I believe State Parks process accomplishes that. But my only quarrel with the State Parks process is that they need some better science to evaluate those permits that aren't even subject to this particular process. I'll produce it'll look very primitive, but it'll have a flow chart which has got the two boxes in it. Interestingly enough, that's exactly what Governor Kulongoski asks when he's in meetings, and he goes, give me a flow chart, give me a flow chart. And he's, you know, he's a lawyer, he wants to see those things, and so I will do that for you, Representative Richardson. I appreciate the question.
I appreciate the fact that you're open to working with LCDC on amending this bill to the point where we can have them along with us on it.
Of course. Well, thank you, and I appreciate their flexibility, and I think we've all learned a lot from this process, and thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Again, I'm going to have to expedite, in that we have a lot of folks yet to speak. The following testimony is not in support of the bill. Mike Kohlmeyer, Fran Rock, and Liz Frankel. Good morning.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Mike Kohlmeyer, and this testimony is on behalf of 1,000 Friends of Oregon. And I have submitted written testimony, and I will not, in the interest of time, I will try to very briefly summarize that. I do agree with some of the testimony that you've heard earlier that this is a fairly simple issue. The question is whether or not you should make a new public policy decision that would reduce protection afforded to Oregon beaches. And Rule 18 currently provides protection that would be decreased by House Bill 3228. And it would be decreased because the definition of development would be expanded to include public development as well as private development. I believe that the public policy decision that is contained in the rule and that carves out a very narrow grandfather clause for private development that can be permitted for riprap or for other beachfront protected structures is the right public policy decision. And I think the Land Conservation and Development Commission made that decision conscientiously and consciously, and I rely upon testimony of Ann Squire, who was a member of the commission in 1984 when the definition of development was incorporated into the rule. And her testimony includes the following comments, and I've attached her full testimony to my written testimony. And she testified as follows. Goal 18 reflected a judgment that hardening of beachfront areas was to be avoided, except as justified by a careful exception process, or where necessary to protect significant pre-existing private investment. I think there's a very logical reason for grandfathering private property investment when new restrictions are applied. But I'm not sure that the same grandfathering, the same relief is necessary for public development and for public agencies. Public agencies can fully support the public value that is being protected. I think we all agree that Oregon beaches are a public value that should be protected. So I believe it is appropriate for public agencies, both state and local, to participate in that protection. And to the extent that that this would change the process. It would not change the process that citizens have to go through, but it would simply eliminate part of the process that we now require public agencies to go through with respect to public development that existed prior to 1977. So having said that, I believe the decision is fairly simple. You're making a public policy decision whether or not to decrease protection to Oregon beaches by grandfathering public development as well as private development, and I urge you not to do so. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Ms. Frankel?
Thank you very much. My history began with this, and I will be turning in a copy, which I have, of testimony which the League presented to the Land Conservation Development on October 24th. And with few exceptions, our concern still remains, that is, there is a difference between the goal
and the goal as it was established. That was, a goal is a goal, which is not the same as, actually as a statute, it isn't the same as the implementation. The goal is what Mike mentioned, talking about why we established it in the first place. The goal was to protect the beaches and the dunes. From the time that the league first heard about this, our concern was over this question of exceptions, and we've been on the battlefront in lots of exception situations because generally people don't want to take the exception route. You can ask DLCD, and they will say that most exceptions processes do succeed. The denial rate is small. You can ask that. They have told us that. I accept that as fact. For some reason, people don't like to go through the exceptions process. Yes, it costs more money. The argument that's being made about lots of these structures is that it will be impossible because of emergency situations. The governor has the authority to deal with emergency situations. He has that authority and can use it. It isn't as though you're going to have a highway that can't be repaired. That simply isn't a problem. I guess lastly I would say we feel very, very strongly that if you're going to make changes to the goals or to the land use planning process, the most important thing you need to remember is the first goal, with reason, was citizen participation. And this is why citizens bought in to the whole concept of land use planning. And that buy-in is essential to the program. And we would suggest if you want to change goals, one of the best ways you can do that is go to the public and find out what they want. And I guess I'd bet they want protection for beaches and dunes. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ms. Rack.
Thank you, Chairman Garrett, members of the committee. My name is Fran Recht. I volunteer as the conservation director of Oregon Shores Conservation Coalition. It's a nonprofit organization that was formed in 1971 from the citizens group that helped pass the Oregon Beach Law. For 32 years, our group has fought to defend that public interest in our beaches and the right of the public to access our beaches. I took time off from work today to speak to your committee on behalf of Oregon Shores to emphasize the amount of grassroots support that exists for our beaches. A decision to provide less protection for our beaches than exists now, and that would be exactly what you would be doing if you would pass HB 3228, because it would greatly expand areas of our coast that could be riprap. Decreases protection for our coast because it takes it hardens the shoreline, which can damage the beach itself by blocking sand supply and causing scour, as well as damaging adjacent properties by deflecting wave energy. HB 3228 would greatly expand those areas of the beach that would be eligible for riprap and would result, we believe, in more riprap. In light of the dynamic nature of the coastal process, including sea level rise, increasing wave heights, it is also not a permanent solution to the problems and can do little to stop massive landsliding that is not caused by wave erosion. This bill has been presented as a way to stop the problems. For example, the Cape Cod slide has nothing at all to do with the Cape Cod slide where the landslide initiates above. It has nothing to do with slides that initiate above. It has to do with wave erosion, which is only a very small subset of what causes problems for our highway and road systems. When the issue of changing the development of Gully came to, it was more limited. It was only going to exempt 20 miles of Highway 101 from application of this rule. Public testimony was huge. I'll provide this as an exhibit. This is the copy of the record that was submitted into the hearing at the time. These are emails, letters, postcards, covered. Copy double-sided. that came in opposition to changes the goal. It said, no, do not change Goal 18. Do not exempt ODOT from going through the exception process. This was a testimony from AOC, Oregon Coastal Zone Management Association, the Realtors Association, that said, we need this change. The definition that you would change today has been in place for 18 years. There's never been a problem with it. Why now? We understand there's been representations made to the Coastal Caucus that this is all about Spencer Creek Bridge and the slides, and that this exception process has held up ODOT for 4 or 5 years. That's absolutely not true. I live in Depot Bay. I use Highway 101 to go to my work on a daily basis. I want that road to be in good shape. But it's not true that the exception process has held up ODOT to do anything. The bridge has been in place for a number of years now. ODOT only started their federal environmental impact statement process this past year. There was this first scoping meeting. They could have started that when they put the temporary bridge in. The neutral mediator hired by ODOT, Parks, DLCD, has done an assessment of how much a goal exception, how much time and cost a goal exception would take. The figure they provide is 6 months to do a goal exception, and it would cost about $50,000. So the numbers you heard today were a little bit off in terms of 3 years and $100,000.
Can you begin to wrap up your
testimony, thank you, please? There's testimony, good testimony, in the documentation from DLCD about why this process is not redundant, and in the testimony from Parks, why this process is not redundant as has been presented to you. This process is, the exception process is a local process where local citizens can testify about why they think riprap should or should not be used, and have the options been seriously considered. What this goal language does is require, and you can consider costs, it requires those agencies to take a look at options, and if options exist, it requires those options to be taken to avoid damage to our beach. Our beach is a treasured resource, as you all know. It doesn't belong to any one district or coastal people. It belongs to all of us in the state, and we all have a reason to protect it. I urge you not to make changes to House Bill 3228. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Any questions of this panel? Representative?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Fran, I just wanted to ask you, is it your feeling that if we do amend the definition of infrastructure to include public infrastructure, that they will go immediately to riprap as the only solution that gets considered, and they won't even look at other alternatives, even if they're feasible?
Yes, I do believe that. When you have a hammer, I like to say this, when you have a hammer, everything starts looking like a nail. And it's easy to riprap. It's harder to start looking at other options, such as moving things out of harm's way. Yes, I absolutely believe that, and that's why it's a concern.
Representative Greenlee.
Yeah, I'd really like to ask a question of the legal interpretation, because sometimes legal interpretations and common sense don't necessarily flow together. But your notion that the law said it's protecting the private property interests that were there before 1977, and is it your position that protecting the roads into the private property, the sewers that might feed the private property, protecting those, even though they're publicly owned, is not protecting the private property itself?
The question really revolves around the definition of development in the current Goal 18 language. And the way it is worded is that for the purposes of this requirement, and this requirement is implementation requirement number 5, for the purposes of this requirement and implementation requirement number 7, which does not necessarily deal with what we're talking about today, development in quotation mark means houses, commercial and industrial buildings, and vacant subdivision lots which are physically improved through construction of streets and provision of utilities to the lot and includes areas where an exception to two above has been approved. So the wording there is I believe, a careful indication that they were talking about significant private property investments, using Anne Squire's language. But it also would protect a subdivision that has been improved through the construction of streets, and obviously would also protect those streets. It carves out private investment. It doesn't grandfather purely public investment, although if the protection of public investment was necessary to protect the private investment, I believe that could rightfully be done under the existing goal language.
Can I follow up?
If you can make it quick.
Very quick.
Those streets that we just talked about, which might be public streets, would be protected under this language, you say?
I believe that would be possible under the current language, yes, sir.
Thank you.
Thank you. Seeing no further questions, thank you, panel. Our final three are Harlan Levy, John Rosenberger, and Linda Ludwig. Good morning, and I again will have to ask all three of you, if you will, to give us the Reader's Digest version, if you can.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I am Harlan Levy, staff attorney for the Oregon Association of Realtors. Mr. John Chandler also asked me to speak on behalf of the Oregon Building Industry Association this morning with reference to this bill. Both of our organizations do support House Bill 3228 and would ask that this committee go ahead and pass the bill out. I will try to be brief, but in a nutshell, we support the bill because we believe that all that you would be doing is codifying the status quo that has existed on the beach since Goal 18 was adopted in 1977. It would be, and this goes to a question that Representative Greenleaf just asked the previous speaker, we believe that it would be absurd for the state to allow you to protect a house that existed prior to 1977, but not let you protect the road or the sewer or the water lines that lead into that house. And in fact, that's exactly what this bill ensures will not happen. Prior to the Goal 18 amendment process that you heard reference to, we all believe that the infrastructure was included in the definition of development, and it wasn't until the department brought forward that Goal 18 amendment process that was called into question. So again, all that we would be doing is codifying the status quo, and we will support this bill and hope that you pass it out. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Levy.
Chair Gerard, members of the committee, for the record, I'm John Rosenberger. I'm the Deputy Director for Highways for the Oregon Department of Transportation. This bill would affect the Department of Transportation if it was approved, primarily Highway 101. if approved, this bill would assist us in keeping those Highway 101 as well as other highways along the coast and protecting those assets for Oregonians. I would make one comment in relation to testimony you heard earlier. ODOT does not go to riprap immediately on projects. We do an extensive alternatives analysis of projects. Riprap comes into play primarily in emergency situations where we are charged by statute to keep the roads open. So when we do have a slide, an emergency, we try to get that road open as quickly as possible, and that's where riprap would come into play in most situations. And with that, I'm available to answer any questions.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Linda Ludwig from League of Oregon Cities. City officials believe and continue to believe, have believed in the past, that roads and infrastructure qualify for development under Goal 18, that definition. We believe this bill is all about clarifying that definition prior to January of 1977 and giving LCDC definitive legislative direction regarding that definition. We concur and support DLCD's conceptual amendment and would ask that you support the bill and pass it out with that amendment.
Thank you. Any questions of this panel?
Mr. Chair.
Representative?
Thank you, John. I just wanted to ask you, in those emergency situations that you just alluded to, are you prevented from putting up riprap by Goal 18 in those situations?
Chair Gerard, Representative Rosenbaum, no. We are. We have authority to declare an emergency, and we can go in and use riprap.
So follow up, Mr. Chair.
Follow.
Then, if we're talking about situations where riprap is necessary to protect the public, why isn't that exception sufficient to cover the situations that we're talking about with this bill?
Chair Gerard, member Representative Rosenbaum, it's a question of timing. Spencer Creek is a good example. We go through a federal environmental process. We look at alternatives. If the alternative that comes out of that includes riprap, then you go into an exception process of local government. When you complete the local government exception process, then you go into the parks process. All three of those processes take time, take money. They cannot be done concurrently. The federal process precludes us predetermining an outcome. So we have to go completely through the federal process, which is subject to appeal by those who would oppose the final outcome. Then we would use the information we collect in the federal process to go through the local process at the city or county. That process, again, is subject to appeal. Once that concludes, then we would go into the parks process, assuming that we made it through all of the other ones. So it's a timing question. I think Mr. Hossing talked to you about the duplicative types of processes that we're going through for different types of things. This is one example on highway projects.
Another follow-up, Mr. Chair. I'm not sure that was really responsive to my question, because I was asking you, if it's an emergency, it sounds like you can intervene right now.
Chair Gerard, Representative Rosenbaum, yes, we do. We intervene. The exception process does not come into play in an emergency.
Mr. Chair, very quickly.
Representative? How would that process, you just named this three-part process, how would it change if this bill passes?
Chair Gerard, Representative Greenlake, if the bill were to pass and we had a project on Highway 101, we would go through the federal process. If the federal process determined that riprap was the alternative that was chosen for the project, we would then go to state parks directly for a permit. So the local land use process, exception process, would not be required for Goal 18. A local land use process may be required if ODOT would be required to get a land use permit from the city or the county.
Thank you, sir.
Representative Richardson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Levy, I just want to get something clear as an attorney. Would you answer this for me? From all the testimony that's coming in, my understanding that this bill is to take back and reestablish what existed before 1984 and allow someone that's in this situation to not have to go through two permit processes, but merely go to the Parks and Recreation or Parks Department, and they would then have to do an evaluation to give a permit.
Mr. Chair, Representative Richardson, my understanding of this bill is this codifies the status quo that's always existed throughout the time that we've had Goal 18. It's only been recently, in the past year, that questions have arisen with respect to development. The term of development, does it include or does it not include this type of infrastructure? So my understanding is all you are doing is codifying what's always existed.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, Campbell, thank you very much.
Thank you.
I would ask that Mr. Hoosing and Mr. Spangler get together with those that have testified today and see if you can work an amendment and come back to this committee next Tuesday, and we will schedule this bill for a work session on Tuesday, and hopefully we'll be able to have a cord enough to move the bill. Okay? I will close the public hearing on House Bill 3228 and open a hearing on House Bill 3211. And Representative Farr has been way too patient. He's been in the back of the room for almost 45 minutes getting an education on land use. Please come forward, Representative. The administrator will read the bill.
Yes, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 3211 requires a majority of voters in the territory to be annexed and a majority of voters in the city or district annexing a territory to approve the annexation plan under which the city or district may annex a territory within the urban growth boundary. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, current law, which is Oregon Revised Statute Chapter 195.215, provides that if a majority of all votes cast in territory proposed to be annexed affirms the annexation plan, then the governing body is required to proclaim adoption of the annexation plan. Mr. Chair.
Representative Ackerman.
I'm scheduled also to testify with Representative Forrest, if I could.
Please. It's very impressive to have two representatives on the other side here. This is...
I want to ask questions of Ackerman.
You will not be permitted.
Oh, sorry.
To grill the good attorney from this committee.
I told Representative Farr this committee is really tough on witnesses and asks hard questions.
No, you're on that side now.
Get even time, isn't it?
Good morning. Whomever would like to go first.
Mr. Chair, Committee, I'm Representative Pat Farr from Northwest Eugene and rural Lane County. I'm here to testify on the House Bill 3211. I live in Bethel. Bethel's a large portion of Eugene, about a fifth of the voters of Eugene, that really doesn't resemble much the rest of Eugene. We have our own school district. We're physically removed from Eugene by railroad yards and industrial areas, and we vote differently from the rest of Eugene. Every time the city of Eugene places any measure on the ballot, we vote against it. Sometimes strongly enough to fail the measure citywide. Whether it's a measure for libraries, parks, public safety, whatever it is, we vote against it. But so you don't just think that we vote against anything that's taxation, we always pass our own school measures. So why is there such antipathy in my district toward the city of Eugene? Well, in 1965, my district was its own city. We were annexed into the... it wasn't actually an incorporated city. It was a rural area, but it had its own sort of downtown. In 65, we were annexed into the taxing district of Eugene against our will. And to this day, we feel that we didn't get our money's worth. Today, we have another district, Santa Clara, whose residents are afraid of annexation and really don't want it. They should have a choice, and Eugene citizens should also have a separate choice. Now, there are some complex service issues in Santa Clara, sewer, fire, police, but there are issues that really need to be addressed by a different situation, by a different process. This bill introduces a system that's fair, and I hope we pass it through the committee, and we'll pass it on the House floor. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Vice Chair, and the remaining members of the committee. My name is Robert Ackerman. I'm from House District 13. It adjoins Representative Farr's district on the east side. A good portion of my former district, District 39, was where Representative Farr's district is right now. I live in what's called the River Road area, which is in the north and slightly to the northwest of Eugene. This is an area like Santa Clara, further to the north, which is within the urban growth boundary, however, is an unincorporated area. It also has other characteristics in that we're fully urbanized. We have streets, sewers, public water, public lights, and almost completely developed in terms of infill of lots, and have a variety of commercial centers. The city of Eugene has taken a piecemeal approach to annexation by requiring only consent annexation, which is fine. But what we are speaking to now is the fact that since we are fully urbanized, we should not be brought into the city limits of Eugene without a vote of the people. The only principle I can think of that really applies and might make sense here is the political principle of taxation without representation, because if we're brought in without a vote of the people in the annexed area, we're accepting a tax base and tax policies and even social policies of the city of Eugene with which we may not agree and with which we have not had an opportunity to participate through representative government. So it's a good political principle. I think it's a good principle for the furtherance of good government to require, at least at the minimum, that if there's going to be an annexation, that the annexed area be vote in favor of that. Representative Farr spoke of a few difficulties we have in the area, and certainly I think the biggest one is
the delivery of police services between the police and between the sheriff and the of the county and the police of the city of Eugene. I've always maintained they could handle that on a geographic basis by an intergovernmental agreement. They've made it more complicated than it need be. My main point, therefore, is that in a fully urbanized area, that area should consent to annexation and should not be forced to annex beyond its will. Thank you for your time.
Any questions of the committee other than Representative Greenlick?
Oh, I'm kidding. I want a chance to get advice from the committee's political council, one of the two political councils, if I might. A brief question. Representative Ackerman, how would Eugene now, without this bill, how would Eugene go about annexing your district if they decided they wanted to do it?
Well, two ways. I mentioned consent annexations,
right. Other than that.
And the city is requiring that as a condition for building permits and development of land, since the county has ceded that authority to them. So it's a consent annexation. I think there may be other annexation proposals. I'm not fully aware of what they are as to how otherwise we could be annexed. Maybe President Farr knows.
My understanding is that it would be a vote of the people in the annexed area and inside of the city to annex them, but it would be a consolidated vote, so the people of the annexed area wouldn't have
a vote of the whole unit.
Yeah.
So it could be overwhelmed by the city,
which is what happened in Bethel.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Seeing none, thank you, John.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We have, because again of time, committee, we have been had our time extended a little bit by the clerk as far as our floor session, and we'll be, when the vote arrives on the floor, we will be called to vote at that time. In the meantime, we'll continue with the hearing. And we have two mayors with us, the mayor of Happy Valley, Eugene Grant, and the mayor of Milwaukee, James Bernard, if they would come forward. And we also have a guest that's over 100 miles away. Is that Lane Marvone? I don't. Okay. Gentlemen, please proceed.
Chair Gerard and members of the committee, Eugene Grant, mayor of Happy Valley. I am also a real estate and land use attorney professionally and have over 20 years experience in dealing with these kind of issues. I am a Republican, Mayor Bernard is a Democrat, and I just mentioned that to emphasize that we're here in a nonpartisan position together on this bill. And I previously sent a letter and some proposed amendments to Chair Gerard and to the committee members. I hope you had an opportunity to review those. I've got another copy with me that I can leave if necessary as part of the public record. Happy Valley is right adjacent to about 15,000 acres that have been added to the urban growth boundary in Portland that's going to be urbanized. And so this is a very real issue for Happy Valley as far as whether that's going to urbanize as an incorporated area inside a city or an unincorporated area outside.
And mayors, again, because of time, I'm going to ask if you can...
Sure.
Condense what you have to say.
Right.
I don't like to do that to elected officials, but...
You know, we tend to run on if we're not careful, right?
Well, I didn't really want to say that. But thank you very much.
Right.
You don't
have the I believe this bill would be counterproductive to smart growth. It won't stop growth. This is not about growth. The growth in the urban area is decided by the urban growth boundary decision. That's a completely different decision. This is solely a question of whether an area that is going to urbanize or has already been urbanized should be in a city or not in a city. Are we going to make it harder to get that area inside a city or easier? Are we going to facilitate annexation? This bill would make it harder. It would essentially create a double majority requirement and give a veto power to the area to be annexed. These areas cannot be adequately served with full urban services the way they can inside a city. The counties don't have the funding to provide the kind of road maintenance and repairs. They don't get the gas tax money for that, but cities do. They don't have the money for policing. They can't provide the parks. They have rural-type land development standards. They don't really meet the kind of smart growth land development standards that cities have. And what you get in these areas, ultimately, over the long term, is a form of blighted, dysfunctional urbanization. And I grew up in Eugene. I know the River Road area and the Bethel area very well, and no offense to those areas, but they do have severe problems because they were not developed and urbanized inside a city. And either a new city or an existing city would greatly improve those areas. And I can point out many examples long-term where areas that are unincorporated become blighted, like the sort of infamous Felony Flats area that is just to the west of the city of Happy Valley in Clackamas County, right near the Multnomah County line. So the public policy, good public policy, is to try and facilitate these areas getting inside of cities, not to make it harder for them to get inside of cities. What we're trying to do here is force a square peg into a round hole. We're trying to allow areas that are unincorporated to be urbanized like a city, but not have city government. And it ends up being dysfunctional. One thing we need to do, if you do pass a bill in this area, at a minimum I would hope you would adopt the amendment that I proposed that would prevent the problem from getting worse and that would require that any new urbanization be inside of a city, that you not allow counties to create these sort of dysfunctional, unincorporated, urbanized areas. But I don't think it is good public policy to make it harder to annex these existing areas. Cities need to solve the existing problem of these large unincorporated areas that gradually start sliding down the slippery slope to blight because they lack adequate urban services. And to make it harder to annex them only makes it less likely that we'll ever be able to solve those problems. We have a large area to the south of Happy Valley that is unincorporated, that is a very nice area right now, but the roads in the areas that were developed 10 or 15 years ago, their roads are already going. They're alligator. They're going to fall apart within just a couple of years, and the county doesn't have any funds to repair those. I understand the appeal of the argument of no taxation without representation, but we're not talking here about annexation without a vote. We're talking about what's the right kind of vote. And careful thought was given to the voting requirement that is in there now that allows a vote of the entire area and doesn't provide this double majority where the area to be annexed has a veto power. And I think that anyone with experience in these kind of city annexations in these unincorporated areas will tell you from long experience that they will always veto it. They will always vote a short-sighted pocketbook sort of veto against annexation because they don't want to pay city taxes, and it's a very short-sighted vote that in the long term reduces their property values and eventually leads to a very blighted area. And so I would urge you to either not pass the bill, or if you do pass it, to adopt the amendments that I've proposed that would actually facilitate those areas being incorporated in cities. If they don't like the city next door, like Eugene, incorporate their own city. They should incorporate their own, but we should not have these blighted, unincorporated areas that are not served the way with urban services that they need to be a healthy city, to be a city that functions. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Committee, I might mention that originally we did not have this bill scheduled to be heard, but it was because of the influx of email and communication with the chair of this committee from the people who support this bill. That is the reason why it is being heard this morning. So,
Mr. Chair, can I just make one response to that? I sent this letter to all of the mayors in the Portland metro region. I serve on the Metropolitan Policy Advisory Committee, and I received numerous responses in endorsing my position as being good public policy and what the legislature ought to do. I didn't have a single local government leader say that they supported this bill. They unanimously opposed it.
Thank you, Mayor. Mayor Bernard?
Mr. Chair, committee members, currently we're studying...
You need to identify yourself.
Oh,
first,
I'm Jim Bernard. I'm the mayor of Milwaukee.
Thank you.
We're currently studying annexation within our UGB, and Mayor Eugene Grant mentioned an area called Felony Flats. Clackamas County no longer has the funding to support policing in this area. We're interested in providing that service, and we're interested in protecting Johnson Creek from the many houses that are currently on septic tanks and failing. We need to promote annexation. We need to be out there promoting the city and selling these people on good public policy and protection of our environment. And if we make this a more difficult task, we will fail, and our areas like Felony Flat will continue to decay. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions of our distinguished guest? Representative Ackerman.
Yes, Mr. Grant, you have some familiarity with the River Road area. I want you to tell me what part of River Road is blighted.
Well, I'm just going from the recollection when I grew up there. I left in 1979 from the Eugene area, but I went out to River Road frequently because of the church that was out there where we had church meetings, not every week, but on a regular basis. And my perception, it's just based on my recollection over the 20 years that I lived there, going from the city of Portland, city of Eugene, where I lived. I lived in West Eugene in the Churchill area, driving out there to River Road to that church, there was inadequate streets, there were lack of sidewalks, there were many rundown buildings. It just had a generally sort of rundown and sort of semi, I mean, it was urbanized, you know, it already was urbanized at that point in time, but there was a very noticeable lack of the public infrastructure that you see in the city. And the buildings that were there were noticeably, you know, on average, not of the same quality as in Eugene, and that's what I meant. Now, I don't mean any offense to that area. There's very many nice homes, very many nice businesses, and I know it's sensitive to talk about an area being blighted, and there's degrees of blight, and it takes many, many years. A Felony Flats didn't start out as Felony Flats. You know, it took it 20 or 30 or 40 years to get to where it is today, where it's a very badly decayed area. And gradually over time, that is what happens in unincorporated urbanized areas.
Follow up, Mr. Chair. I just want to state for the record that I know where Felony Flats is, and it's within the incorporated city limits of Eugene. It's not in the River Road area. Are you familiar with the widening of River Road and the extension of public sewers by the city of Eugene into the River Road Santa Clara area?
Let me respond to the first point. The Felony Flats we're talking about is the one in Portland. And that,
I'm sorry, I'm talking about the one in Eugene.
Yeah, right. I guess every metro area has one, right? ours up there is in an unincorporated area. And the sewers, I'm guessing that may have happened after 1979 when I left.
How about the widening of River Road into a four-lane boulevard? Have you seen that?
I don't think so. Since I left there in 1979, I've visited Eugene, you know, maybe five or six times, but I haven't had occasion to go back out on River Road since then.
And have you examined recently the commercial areas both on the north and south side of Beltline?
I have been on Beltline, yes.
Cross-examination mode now.
Yes, sir.
All right. I just want to say, Mr. Chairman, that my blighted house in the River Road area has appreciated in value 100% over the past 10 years.
I would have to concur, Representative, on behalf of all the people in Oregon who live in unincorporated areas. I'm not quite sure they'd be happy with knowing that they're all blighted areas. That's an awful lot of people in Oregon, and there's an awful lot of very fine homes there, Mayor. Thank you both for your testimony. Linda Ludwig, Art Schlack. And I think that will conclude all the folks that are opposed to this bill. Linda?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Linda Ludwig from the League of Oregon Cities.
Annexation processes in Oregon are incredibly complex. There are 7 different types of proceedings to annex territory to a city in a non-boundary commission area, and there are just as many different ways in a boundary commission area. There are different procedures for urban service provider annexations and for annexations that include or exclude districts. These procedures are outlined in 4 different chapters of Oregon revised statute, chapter 195, 198, 199, and 222. I have spent the last 2 years trying to become knowledgeable about annexations, and let me tell you, it's a very complex, difficult subject. You're going to hear a lot about annexations today without understanding the different types of annexations and what they're used for. And Mr. Chair, I want to just very bluntly, very carefully say, with all due respect to our prior testimony, Bethel was not brought into the city of Eugene under an urban service provider annexation. And to the best of my knowledge, the city of Eugene is not looking to utilize that method for river road problems. This bill won't fix those problems. And if you'll give me a minute, I'll explain how very narrow and very focused urban service provider annexations are and how they came about. They came about as a part of Senate Bill 122 in the 1993 session. In 1993, primarily cities and districts were squabbling about who's going to be providing services and talking a lot about the efficiencies of service and not duplicative services within districts. Urban service agreements were established prior to that time between counties and districts and metro and districts. But in 93, Senate Bill 122 brought cities into that mix, into coordinating planning and establishing those urban service agreements for the provision of those types of services, which included sanitary sewer, water, fire protection, parks, recreation, streets, roads, and mass transit. Those agreements are very complex, they're very technical, and they talk about the responsibilities of cities and counties and districts in planning, the interests of those districts. They talk about each party and how they go about provision of services, who does what. They specify the services, the functional role of the service providers, the future service areas, and those agreements and that legislation was passed, again, to eliminate the competing interests between cities and districts in providing services. Those urban service provider agreements are still what we are functioning and working with today. Senate Bill 122 also established a new method of annexation for those cities that had concluded these urban service agreements with all service providers within a territory that was proposed for annexation. It was a very specific, a very narrow type of annexation where an area of land was brought in under the annexation plan, which the plan already had the benefit of lots of findings and public hearing requirements. Those cities have to develop an annexation plan that talks about the timing, the sequence of annexation, the standards of urban service availability, and oftentimes that plan has already incorporated residents that have been provided services all along. Once an annexation plan has been adopted by a city, again, this plan has had a process of findings and public hearings. That plan has to be submitted to the voters residing in the territory to be annexed and within the city within a single election. That type of annexation is only available to cities that have completed those urban service provider agreements. And we have only seen one of those types of annexation since its inception in 1993, and that was in the city of Bend. This type of annexation was purposely different from the voting requirements of all the other different kinds of annexation methods that bring property into the city limits on a property-by-property basis. because it brings in an area of land, not just a single property, under an annexation plan that has already had in-depth public hearings, findings, and been approved with service providers.
Linda, do you have much more?
No, that's pretty much the background. We are very opposed to this bill in that that very narrow, specific form of annexation would require a double majority vote by this bill. The burden requirement for those annexations was specifically different and set out differently because of the Urban Service Provider Agreement requirement for those annexations and the annexation plan requirement. There are many places and many cities, as you have heard, that are providing services outside of their boundaries. And this type of annexation is an important tool to keep in the toolbox of what cities can use.
Thank you. Thank you, Linda. I'm going to briefly recess the public hearing on 3211 and open a public hearing on House Bill 3013 to allow the testimony of Representative Morgan.
3013. Thank you.
Representative, we appreciate you taking time from your busy schedule.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Susan Morgan. I'm State Representative for House District 2, which is Douglas County and parts of Josephine and Jackson County. And I do wish to thank you, Representative Garrard, as Chair of the Committee, for indulging me and changing the order of your hearing today to accommodate my schedule. First of all, I want to talk to you about the implications that have fallen on the aggregate mining industry because of a couple of LUBA decisions and because of some decisions that recently have been acted by the National Marine Fisheries Service. And there's been two LUBA decisions and one action by National Marine Fisheries that severely limited the industry's ability to get to the sources of aggregate that they need to get to. This is having a significant impact down in the southwestern part of the state. And what's happening to us is that sources of aggregate that we had included in inventories to do an orderly kind of development and to use in sourcing construction projects in that area has kind of been thrown into disarray, and we essentially don't have anywhere near what we thought we had in an accessible inventory. And you can imagine, as we're trying to put our stress right now on economic development and job creation, the havoc that this is wreaking down in that part of the state. And I don't think that we're alone in it geographically in being in that predicament. But basically, if you take a look at aggregate, that's the beginning of a whole lot of construction projects. You can't build roads without good sources of aggregate. You can't prepare building sites. You can't make concrete. You can't pave roads. It's one of the real basic building blocks of any kind of construction, particularly heavy construction. And what the bill will essentially do is take care of one little piece of this, and it has to do with counties' ability to make decisions on non-significant mine sites within their jurisdictions. And what it'll do is just restore a local government's power to conditionally approve those non-significant mine sites. It returns the status quo and kind of rolls back a LUBA decision that we're trying to deal with right now. And I think that as you get into the testimony on the bill and as the committee administrator explains the bill, you'll begin to see what the bill does. But I just want to talk to you and make sure that you understand the economic impact that not making these resource sites available is going to have in the state as we try to go into a job restoration situation. If we have to go further away to get these aggregate sources, and right now we're pretty much being effectively blocked from taking aggregate off of agricultural lands and out of any kind of waterways, so that pushes us up into the forest lands, and there isn't a lot of good rock in the Coast Range. It's a weathered basalt that's up there, and it isn't the kind of quality of rock that you need to use for aggregate and the kinds of things that you need to use aggregate for. So all of the construction projects that are online right now, and a lot of what's going on in terms of public construction in my neck of the woods are the I-5 bridge improvement projects. All the aggregate to those projects, if we have to bring it in from farther away, is going to significantly increase the cost of the projects, because you can appreciate how much it costs to haul something as heavy as aggregate, and that the more value you add to that, the more cost you add to the project. So please bear that in mind as you work through this issue. I know it's a difficult issue. Emotions run very high on it. But I would ask you to keep in the front of your minds as you deliberate the clear economic impacts that this is going to have on our ability to pull out of this recession. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Representative. We will. Any questions of Representative Morgan? Seeing none, thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr.
We'll recess the public hearing on House Bill 3013 and reopen the public hearing on House Bill 3211. And I was in error in that on page 2 there were two additional people who wanted to speak against this bill, and that's John Chandler and Harlan Levy. And Art, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to leave you out.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, Art Slack with the Association of Oregon Counties, and I had the pleasure of being around in 1993 when Senate Bill 122 was discussed, massaged, and formed into what's in the statute today. We've had a couple of different ways of doing annexation, and it was in 93 as we were looking at annexation and annexation issues, it was determined that we needed another way of looking at annexation rather than, let's say, the individual piecemeal kind of annexation that had been taking place with the triple two-thirds majority, where property owners would petition for annexation to a city to obtain services. We needed a way for a more comprehensive look at annexation based on looking at urban growth boundaries, looking at the service providers that were in the area, and to come up with a plan, if you will, as to how those services were going to be provided and how a city looking at urban development would provide those services over a period of time, and extend those services and annex those lands into the city, be it at one time, at one whole time, or whether it be some blocks of time to efficiently extend those services and provide those for orderly urban development. That's what you have with the second option that is available for an annexation plan. And we support that process. We support the idea of having a vote, one vote, dealing with the issues that are set forth within the statute. And I would call your attention to ORS 195.220, which talks about the provisions of an annexation plan and the issues that it addresses. We support this process and would hope that you support it and would not embrace the proposal that's before you. Thank you.
Mr. Levy? Mr. Chandler looks involved. That's why I went to you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I am Harlan Levy, staff attorney with the Oregon Association of Realtors. We oppose House Bill 3211. I'll be brief. We do support the existing annexation requirements in the statute that Mr. Slack just cited to you. They already are complex. They already do contain much due process and notification requirements, and we don't believe that there ought to be a double majority requirement, which is what this bill would set up. With that, I will conclude. Thank you.
Mr. Chandler.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, John Chandler, Legislative Advocates. And I find myself in a somewhat anomalous situation as I was sitting in the back of the room listening particularly to the testimony from Representative Ackerman and Representative Farr. And it's anomalous in the sense that I'm not sure I necessarily want to help them fix the problem they articulated, but this bill doesn't do it, I don't believe. And that's why I felt I was compelled to testify to that effect. Oregon annexation law, I have read, is the worst in the country. And I don't know how one evaluates that or who does the evaluating, but I do know that Oregon annexation law is tangled and complicated and very, very difficult to understand, and I don't understand it. I do know, though, that the section being amended in House Bill 3211 deals with that one particular type of annexation, urban service provider annexations only. It doesn't affect any of the other types of annexation Ms. Ludwig and Mr. Schmack have talked about. In fact, the statute that this section in which this section resides specifically says that this method of annexation, the urban service agreement type, is in addition to and does not affect or prohibit other methods of annexation. What we're talking about here is changing the requirements for voting on the annexation plan. Mr. Schlack and Ms. Ludwig have already walked through the details there, but basically this section of the statute talks about what to do when the water district and the city can't agree on who's going to provide water service. So they go ahead, they have meetings, they have public hearings, they take testimony, they involve the public through a comprehensive planning process. It's all set forth in the statute. Then the plan is developed about who does what, when, what sequence of annexation would occur, what services get provided, and who pays for what, all that sort of urban service, water, sewer, transportation, hospital, whatever it might be, service agreement. That plan is what's being voted on in 195.215. That's the section being amended. I mean, in a sense, I mean, these are urban service annexations. In a sense, though, the vote isn't on the annexation per se, it's on the plan for annexation, which in itself sets out the sequence and timing of the annexations. If I understood Representative Farr in particular correctly, the concern he had on behalf of his district outside of the city of Eugene, I don't believe those were urban service annexation issues that he was worried about. And so, as I said, I'm not sure this statute fixes the problem he identified. I spoke to him in the hallway briefly and told him I was going to communicate to you both that point and the point that I'm not sure I want to help him fix it. But it seems to me if we're going to have a conversation about annexation, it ought to be the right one. Oregon annexation law is a mess. And I, this stage of the session, I'm not sure I'd recommend to you that you wander into that thicket. But as I say, I find myself somewhat conflicted here because the first temptation is to let the darn thing go and see what happened. But I think if there is a concern and a problem that we want to address, we ought to do that and not address the one next door to it, which I think this does. And, Mr. Chairman, I'll be glad, by the way, I oppose the bill, but strictly oppose it, amending the wrong statute. Glad to take any questions.
Thank you for defining your position. We appreciate that. Any questions? Seeing none, thank you.
Thank you.
Jim Seabury. Gary Ritter, Elizabeth Lindsay, and we have Susan McKenna. All of these parties are all in favor of this bill?
Yes, Susan McKenna had to go home to take her son to the doctor.
Committee, that will conclude those testifying.
Glenn's here, he's on the list.
Oh, we called you earlier, and no one.
Slide, you join him.
Okay, if you'd like to, well, just remain there, and then we'll have you come up. Go ahead.
You want me to start then?
Yes, please.
Okay.
You need to identify yourself, please.
I'm Elizabeth Grace Lindsay, and I'm the speaker of the Beaver Creek Community Planning Organization. Our CPO is recognized by the county as representing our area. Our CPO is united in our request that you support House Bill 3211 to ensure that ORS 195-215 is interpreted to provide for the double majority voter-approved annexation. Current Oregon law does not provide a means for rural communities to protect themselves from unwanted urbanization by adjacent urban areas. Oregonians are sensitive to the need to respect property rights. There is a need for the cumulative property rights of a community to be respected. There is a need for the community-wide property rights, that is the right to remain a community, to be respected. When a rural community is united in its rural vision for itself, it should have the protection of Oregon law behind it. House Bill 3211 is a rural community rights protection bill. Because current law on annexations, ORS 195-215, does not clearly explain that the majority of votes from a territory considered for annexation must support annexation, but cities can interpret the law to allow them to combine the territory's votes with those of the higher population city, the voters in the rural communities will always be outvoted by the city because of the rural area's smaller population. Beaver Creek is a small rural community that I live in, and it's defined by Oregon law as an unincorporated rural community, and it's shown as such on county maps, and it used to be called a rural center. It's the same thing. Our community is adjacent to a city where discussions of expansion does not consider our community's interests or desires or the benefits of having an agricultural area next to the city. We know of other communities in our area, such as Damascus, and other parts of Oregon, such as near Bend, that have already been involuntarily selected for urbanization. Our community previously was selected for involuntary urbanization, but we got the decision remanded at LUBA and at the Court of Appeals. We believe our state should protect the rights of rural communities to exist. Currently, only cities, which are urban by definition, but not rural communities, have a legal recognition for their right to exist. House Bill 3211 would help with protecting the cumulative property rights of rural communities. So your support is most appreciated. And I did want to make a correction to one of the earlier testimonies. The mayor of Milwaukee, Bernhardt, said that the metro cities were unanimously opposed to this bill. But I have a letter right here from the copy of a letter that Wes Lynn wrote that tells of their opposition to this bill.
Thank you very much. The three gentlemen, if you can avoid any duplication of Ms. Lindsay's testimony, and if you're in agreement with her, just basically tell us that. Add anything that you think the committee would be interested in, but in the concept of trying to be as brief as we can, we'd appreciate it.
Mr. Chairman, the members of the committee, my name is Jerry Ritter. I'm here representing Oregon Communities for a Voice in Annexations. You have my written testimony, so I'll ask you to look that over in your spare time, which I know you have lots of these days. The whole debate on this thing boils down to the issue of fairness. We're not paid lobbyists. We're just citizens up here asking you to correct what former Lane County Commissioner Steve Kornacki had called a grossly unfair provision in ORS 195-205-215. In the Bend example that was cited, the Bend UGB people who were targeted for annexation voted 3-1 against the proposal, but they were overwhelmed, as Representative Greenlick so well pointed out, by the Bend city voters who voted 3-1 in favor. The existing language in Section 205 effectively denies those most impacted by annexation voice in the process. Now, the urban service plans and the intergovernmental agreements, urban service agreements that were spoken about earlier, all happened pretty much out of the public eye. The public is not aware of them. They don't participate in them. They're done by city staff and others who have really no financial impact on their wallets from these plans. And it's only after the plans are developed that the public gets involved in a public hearing, and by that time the city considers it a done deal. So I'm going to end my testimony on that. And by the way, I live in one of those blighted UGB areas, too, with very nice streets and orchards, and we're very happy. We pay for the services. We have good services. And we don't want to be annexed without us having a voice in the process. The existing language denies us a voice in the process, and we would ask that you change that, please.
Thank you very much. Both of you can step down if you'd like to, and we'll allow Mr. Is it Morgan?
Margeson
to come forward. Yes, sir. You're next. Yes.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jim Seabury, and I live at 3294 Stark Street in a blighted area called Santa Clara, where I will defy you to drive down Blackfoot in the spring and not completely come unglued. And my home is one of the cheap ones. It's on the market, or could be on the market if I so desired, which I don't. Probably in a neighborhood of $200,000. I am here today. Did you catch me? You think that I'm reading? I am. My background is data processing. I don't like shades of gray. We'll get there in less than 3 minutes.
I can't give you 3 minutes.
Okay. We're on our way.
Okay.
I'm here today on behalf of the River Road Santa Clara Property Owners Association and its 700 plus members and supporters speaking in favor of House Bill 3211. House Bill 3211 is before you today for very valid reasons. Interpretations of ORS 195215 without these proposed changes is plainly bad law and subject to major abuses in its present form. When one reads ORS 195215, you see a statute struggling to assure an independent vote on annexations to the residents in the unincorporated areas of a city's UGB. And then it falls short in total confusion. So confusing that the city of Bend was able to annex its entire urban growth boundary in one fell swoop, using a single combined vote of ORS 195215 as its authority. Oh yes, you may hear testimony in opposition to House Bill 3211, claims of, well, the people living outside the city limits but within the UGB don't pay their fair share for services. Not true. We have a fire district, we have a water district, both which serve a hodgepodge of city annexed properties within our urban growth area. We own the water lines that service those inside development properties. And we give it to them free of charge. Our Santa Clara Fire District developed property, Our Santa Clara Fire District, until recently, through an IGA with the City of Eugene, provided fire services to those same properties at a rate of less than 70 cents per $1,000 of assessed value, while the city was charging these same homeowners a rate upwards of $2.15 per thousand. The rate for our unincorporated area is just shy of $1.05 per thousand. The real question is, who's subsidizing whom? Members of this committee, I have pictures with me taken only yesterday that show areas in the community of Bethel annexed over 20 years ago that show no beneficial signs of services for their having been annexed. I have pictures of areas within 1 mile of Eugene's prime shopping center, Valley River Center, where new homes have been built, sold, and are being lived in. They are without curbs, sidewalks, and the old street is terribly in need of rebuilding. I ask that your committee unanimously pass House Bill 3211, assuring that ORS 195215 will in fact be as intended, a double majority, with in-city and not-in-the-city residents voting separately, where both must carry the majority or there can be no annexation. Thank you for your time. If you have any questions.
Thank you very much for your testimony. We're going to hold questions.
I don't want a question.
He's mumbling. No, would you, you want to mumble out loud? Or okay. Is it Lane?
Lance.
Boy, I am having trouble with your name today, and I apologize for that, Lance.
That's no problem.
You got about 2 minutes.
Okay, Lance Margeson, 16057 South Camellia Court, Oregon City. And even though my post office address is Oregon City, I live in Beaver Creek. We picked that blighted and dysfunctional area because we wanted the life values that went along there. We have pets, we have room for a donkey, we have Christmas trees, etc. If there's a blighted area, it's in Oregon City. You know, it's not out where we are. Also, we did not want the services and the taxation that goes along with them that the city provides. It seems like the cities are saying we can do a better job of land development than the counties. There's virtually no building out in our area at all because of the land use laws. The lots that have been built on have been built on. Also, it's kind of a big brother approach. We can do you a favor even though you don't want us. We can do, provide you these services. You may not want them, but we can provide them for you. This year, Oregon City tried to annex parts of Beaver Creek into the urban growth area. There's no representation by the urban areas on Metro. We don't get a vote on the directors. There's nobody representing us. When we were asked to come to the meetings and speak, our CPOs spoke after the mayors and as individuals. They were not invited to speak as an elected official representing a group of people. I just feel like there are areas that are worth protecting, these rural areas, the agricultural areas, and this double majority is not a panacea, but I think would go a long ways into protecting those areas. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Lance. I appreciate it. We're going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3211 and open a work session on House Bill 3211. Representative Ackerman.
Mr. Chairman, I move that House Bill 3211 be forwarded to the House floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Ackerman moves House Bill 3211 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, the clerk will call the roll.
Representative Rosenbaum.
No.
Representative Greenland.
Yes.
Representative Doyle.
Aye.
Representative Ackerman.
Aye.
Representative Zahner.
Yes.
Representative Richardson.
Aye.
Chair Girard.
Chair votes aye. House Bill 3211 is sent to the floor with a due pass recommendation. And since it's Representative Westland's bill, we'll let him be the carrier. We're going to have to get to the floor, and I apologize to those who came here this morning hoping we'd get to some of the other bills, but we will, at this point, tap the bills in and schedule them as quickly next week as we can get into the schedule. So that's what we're about to do now, just simply tap those bills that we're unable to get in on today.
You need us here?
No, the committee is excused. The chair opens House Bill 3061, public hearing on 3061. The chair closes public hearing on House Bill 3061. The chair opens public hearing on House Bill 2898 and closes public hearing on 2898. The chair opens a public hearing on House Bill 2899 and closes a hearing on House Bill 2899. Chair opens public hearing on House Bill 2945 and closes public hearing on 2945. Chair opens a public hearing on House Bill 3245 and closes public hearing on House Bill 3245. Chair opens a public hearing on House Bill 3408 and closes House Bill 3408. Chair opens a public hearing on House Bill 3017 and closes the House public hearing on 3017. Chair opens a public hearing on House Bill 3144 and closes public hearing on 3144. Chair opens a public hearing on House Bill 2617 and closes a public hearing on 2617. The chair opens a public hearing on House Bill 3315 and closes the public hearing on House Bill 3315. The chair opens a public hearing on House Bill 3137 and closes the public hearing on House Bill 3137. The chair opens a public hearing on House Bill 2909 and closes the public hearing on 2909. The chair opens a public hearing on 2910 and closes a public hearing on 2910. The chair opens a public hearing on House Bill 3404 and closes public hearing on 3404. The chair opens a public hearing on 2790 and closes the public testimony on House Bill 2790. And the chair opens a public testimony on 3561 and closes on House Bill 3561 public hearing. And the chair opens a public hearing on 3121 and closes the public hearing on 3121. And the House, I open a public testimony on 3083 and closes the public testimony, public hearing on 3083. We open public hearing on House Bill 3457 and close on House Bill, the public hearing on House Bill 3457 and open a public hearing on House Bill 3282 and close the public testimony on 3282. We open public testimony on HJR 35 and close the public testimony on HJR 35. The chair opens a public testimony on 3558 and closes the public hearing on 3558. The chair opens public hearing on House Bill 3120 and closes public hearing on 3120. The House, the chair opens a public testimony on House Bill 3181 and closes the public hearing on 3181. And the chair opens public testimony on 3459 and closes the public hearing on 3459. And we adjourn the meeting of the House Committee on Environment and Land Use.